7, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say that we have two sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, and Avemco Insurance. Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots in their planes can have safer flights ahead.
Well, hello, Todd.
Hello, John.
Here we are again. That's the two of us. Greg's on an airplane.
Which means we get to have fun in our own way.
Yep. So what I want to do today, Todd, is the NTSB put out their report. The newspapers have all had time to misidentify half the stuff in there. So I thought it would be good if we just started to walk through some of the report step by step. And as I said to you just before we went on the air, I'd like to start with the place that the press made so much out of, and that's the very beginning.
Before we do that, let's introduce what report we're talking about here. We're recording this show on April 27th, 2026, 4 days after the NTSB released a preliminary report about the collision between a regional jet and a fire truck at LaGuardia Airport, which happened on March 22nd. And the preliminary report did state a lot of factual evidence, did not state a conclusion. That comes in the latter part of the investigation. So the probable cause and the factors that contribute that went to that probable cause are not in there. However, there are things in there which begs questions, which I think should be answered, and so do you. And as you were about to say, we're going to go through the preliminary report in order, but we'll focus on some aspects of it.
Right. We'll just take it in the beginning. The press made a big deal out of the fire and fire trucks out there, and as they should. Right, they were responding to an emergency. There was a whole wagon train of them, I think 7 or so.
And just to set the scene, I'll have a graphic on here for the video portion of this. This is a graphic from the preliminary report that shows where the emergency vehicles were who were going to a particular part of the airport. The emergency vehicles were coming from one side of the landing runway of the regional jet. They had to cross that runway to get to the other side. We don't know how many vehicles were already responding to the emergency that was on the other side of the airport. We do know there were 7 vehicles that were attempting to cross the runway.
Right. So, and the question by everybody that's been raised about the warning lights, about the, first off, the FAA has spent $1 billion outfitting 35 airports with ground radar. Now, ground radar, in and of itself, is not the most accurate information. There's all kinds of clutter. There's all kinds of things in the way. However, the version that the FAA put out there relies upon a transponder on the vehicle. And if you have a transponder, it is very accurate for position, and it can be overlaid on the airport. So people in the tower or wherever there's a receiver for the radar can see exactly what's going on the airport. Without it, it's just a big blob, essentially. So the air traffic controller in this case was very, very limited in what he could see on the radar because of lack of transponders.
If I may, right. There's another graphic I'm putting on the screen right now for those of you who be watching the video that shows a snapshot of what the ground radar was showing the people in the control tower. And you can see its circle on the left side there, circle in blue, has two blob type things. Those two blobs represent the seven emergency vehicles, none of which has transponders, and that particular ground radar resolved those as being two targets. And these two blobs were not adjacent to the runway, they were heading toward the runway. We don't know what dynamic picture was in the control tower, whether it was a continuous video or whether it was updated every 2 seconds. I don't know exactly what, but this snapshot shows something heading toward the runway. At the time, those emergency vehicles were in contact with the control tower, so they were aware that the vehicles were there, and they were somewhat aware of their position, given what the radar could show them.
Right, so the transponders are not all that expensive. We're attempting to find out what kind of pricing they have when you buy them in quantity. Because if you're buying them for, like, the airport crash fire rescue vehicles at the airport, there's probably 20 of those, plus all the other Port Authority vehicles. So it may end up being 60 or 70 or even more vehicles that they have to get transponders for. Now, not every vehicle will need them. Only the vehicles that have occasion to go out on the active taxiways and active runways. And I might state that there's two different driver's licenses for the airport as well. So most airline employees, which I was one for years, had to go for a separate driving test. And almost every airport does that today, to allow me to drive in and around the terminal. 99% of the people that work on the airport do not have the authority or the proper license to go out on the taxiway or runway. The way they get around that is if there's a need for somebody from an airline to go out to their airplane, for example. So if United, in this case, whose airplane was sitting on the other side in an emergency, if United had a crew that they were going to take out there, they would be escorted by a Port Authority vehicle. So you're sort of wagon training out there. You're in a controlled environment. So that's the way they manage having people who don't have that special driver's license to operate on taxiways and runways. That's how they get them out there. But in this case, all the fire department vehicles, all the firemen themselves, all the police department would have that special license. Separate test, driving tests to do that. So right off the bat, that's one of the questions the NTSB is going to ask is the qualifications of the two people in the cab of that fire engine. Did the guy driving at least have that special license? Was the other person aware of that special license, the restrictions on it, and which thereby would say he understood the process with the red lights for crossing the runway and so on, because that's all part of that special license.
Now,
So,
as we said before, we're going to take the report piece by piece, and we gave you a bit of background here. Let me just give you the introduction to it. This was, of course, at LaGuardia, March 22, 2026. The landing aircraft was what used to be called a Bombardier CRJ-900. It's now owned by Mitsubishi Heavy Industries. It was an incoming flight, and you had seven vehicles, four fire vehicles, two other vehicles, and a police car that were going from one side of the airport to the other. The lead fire truck collided with the aircraft. There were two fatalities in the regional jet, the two pilots, one serious injury, a flight attendant, all in the forward part of the aircraft. There are no serious injuries for the other passengers on board the aircraft. And the two occupants of the fire truck, which was hit by the aircraft, they were injured but not critically. The airplane had been flying in from Montreal to LaGuardia. It was nighttime, around 10:30, excuse me, 11:37 at night. There was somewhat limited visibility because of rain and other moisture in the atmosphere, but there were visual flight conditions, that is, several miles of visibility by anyone on the ground and the aircraft coming in. For the vehicles that were moving on the airport property, they were in contact with the control tower. And there's CVR, cockpit voice recorder audio, and other information that shows that they were in contact. One of the two controllers in the tower, the local controller, cleared the aircraft to land, and the other controller was handling ground vehicles. There were only two controllers in the control tower at that time because it was rather late at night, and that was the standard staffing for that situation.
And the reason for that staffing is because they're so shorthanded. Made a decision, and it's all around the country. If you have nighttime, very diminished flight activity, you can get by with controllers working more than one position. And in this control tower, we had two controllers working two positions each. Just after 11 o'clock, I guess it was, we had an airplane landing with an emergency, and they called out the equipment. So we have an airplane that's parked off to the further from the terminal building that's got an emergency that these firemen are responding to. So they have a mission to get to that airplane on the other side of the runway. They have a need. So they were coming at a pretty good clip. I've seen estimates at 30 miles an hour. I don't know if that's true or not. But anyway, they were trying to get there as quickly as they could. And they called when they were a fair distance away from the intersecting runway and taxiway. They called for clearance across the runway, which they were given. So now that's going to raise another question. What did the controller in the tower, believe he was giving them? Did he believe he was giving them carte blanche to cross the runway? Or did he believe something else was supposed to happen? The NTSB will find that out as well.
And there are other potential sources of confusion, which the NTSB didn't go into in detail. Again, this is the preliminary report. One of the vehicles, which was designated Truck 7, was initially trying to contact the tower to coordinate crossing runway. There was some difficulty with communicating with the tower, and Truck 7 coordinated with Truck 1 to actually communicate with the tower. So Truck 1 is the one that eventually got hit. Truck 1 took over for the lead before they crossed the taxiway. Now, the landing aircraft was still some distance away. Roughly, they were about 3.7 nautical miles from touchdown at the time Truck 7 and Truck 1 were coordinating with each other, and the trucks had not yet crossed the runway. So there was some time and distance between the aircraft and the truck.
So there is some confusion around who said what to who and when. You know, was Truck 7 the one doing the communicating initially? Was Truck 7 the one that was cleared across the runway? They touch on it a little bit. I'm anxious to see what they finally get when they have all the interviews done on that issue.
I misspoke earlier. Truck 7, was trying to contact the tower when the aircraft was about 3.7 miles away. By the time Truck 7 coordinated with Truck 1, the airplane was only 2.3 nautical miles away from the taxiway intersection.
Well, at 100 miles an hour, he's going more than 100. He's going 130 or 140. That's 2 miles a minute. So they're not very far out.
And things are happening fairly quickly. Roughly 23 seconds after Truck 1 took over for coordinating, the local controller asks which vehicle needed to cross first. Truck 1 moves to the front of the line. And the aircraft is now only 1.5 nautical miles away, 400 feet altitude. So in 21 seconds, it went from 2.3 nautical miles to 1.5 nautical miles. Only 7 seconds later, and this is something we'll go into in great detail, there were runway entrance lights near the runway that are there to tell the ground vehicles whether they can cross the runway. If they can cross the runway, the red lights are off. If they're not supposed to cross the runway, the red lights are on.
So that raises a very interesting question for this. A first-hand experience working on the airport for many, many years. There's red lights, flashing lights, lights everywhere. And after a while, you tend to turn them off in your head. They don't draw your attention to them the way they should. Right? And 99.9% of the time, it doesn't matter because you have a system you're operating on and you don't get into trouble. It's when there's something abnormal going on that you got to raise your awareness, and sometimes people don't. So I'm not saying these guys didn't. I'm just saying general terms sometimes. So now the NTSB is going to have to look at from witness statements about the lights. So one of the things that I decided to look at because of the lights is what's the requirement for the Port Authority for colorblindness? Because we have one for the pilots, right? I have a friend of mine who went through all his commercial instrument and found out that his colorblindness, he knew he was colorblind, but it was the type that he couldn't get a waiver for. And so I don't know what they have here. On the Port Authority website, they talk about colorblindness, and they talk about a test that they use. When I'm searching around in other areas about this particular test that they use for colorblindness, there's a lot of things on the internet that make you think that maybe this might be a better test. I don't know the answer to that. I'm no doctor, nor are you. But it just calls into question whether or not that's the best test. If you're in line to get a job, you have to take that test before you get the job at the Port Authority. And if you're in line to take that job and you know you have a colorblindness problem, one of the negatives for the particular test that they use is that you can memorize the pieces before you go take the test. And there's a lot of discussion online about that. So I don't know if that's pertinent here or not, but it's something that the NTSB will have to satisfy themselves that it wasn't the case.
And you and I could certainly go to the regulations, both at the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey and for the FAA, and answer the question, are the requirements of the Port Authority as good or better than the requirements of the FAA when it comes to colorblindness tests? And although there's tests on the FAA side for pilots, and you can speak to this, is there a test for example, mechanics? Do they have to have a colorblindness test?
No. No, so, in fact, we've been struggling with that for a while because the airlines themselves, for their inspectors, will require corrected vision. The FAA never says a word about that in the official rules about people who do aircraft inspections and what their eyesight should be. You know, what's the minimum? Do you have to have 20/20 corrected? It's sort of empty. And there's a lot of us, and I'm one of them, that thinks there should be a standard there.
And just take, for example, the vehicles that were traveling, trying to travel across the runway. You have three kinds of drivers. The driver of the police car, the driver of the, I believe, four fire trucks, and the drivers of the other two trucks. One was a tool truck and one was an air stair truck. So the question to me is, okay, if there is a vision requirement for these three types of drivers, what's the likelihood it's all good enough to pass the FAA requirements?
You know, so the FAA doesn't have a standard. They defer to the airports. And I'm not sure if the standard is in the airport regulations. There's a whole section in the FARs that deal with airports. And I'm not sure if there's anything in there that deals with eyesight and colorblindness. And I will check that up before we go too far, much further in our digging into the preliminary report. You know, just suffice to say that the NTSB is going to have some very pointed questions in that whole area of colorblindness because it has such an impact on this accident.
Let me tie together two things we talked about earlier because it comes into play here. One was the fact that you had this ASDX ground radar system that was in place, but the vehicles didn't have a transponder to allow the air traffic controllers to have a more precise location where everyone was. And you spoke in an earlier episode about if you were going to outfit ground vehicles with this sort of equipment, how expensive would it be? And it would be on the order of, let's say if you were talking about all the Port Authority vehicles, on the order of $1 million. Is it $2 million? Is it $500,000? Let's just say for the sake of argument, it's $1 million. Well, you say to yourself, the radar's been here for a while. Why hasn't the Port Authority come up with the money? And you ask yourself, what is the Port Authority? For those of you who don't know, the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey is a fairly comprehensive transportation government entity, separate from New York, separate from the state of New York, separate from the state of New Jersey, that controls Newark, LaGuardia, JFK, all the major bridges and tunnels passing between New York and New Jersey, as well as a couple of other airports, Teterboro in New Jersey and Stewart Airport in upstate New York, as well as the ports along New York and New Jersey. This is an entity that is its own separate governmental entity, which has revenue from all these various sources. They also have real estate, including the World Trade Center site is under the control of the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey. I don't know how much money they have to spare, but this is, in my opinion, the largest transportation governmental entity in the United States, and money should not be an issue, is my opinion.
$1 million for that operation that probably is in the $1 billion range. It's not significant. And especially since it's been out for a while, this isn't something that happened yesterday. The radar has been out there for several years. So it could have been implemented in piecemeal. Hello, aviation enthusiasts, safety professionals, and curious minds. Welcome to Flight Safety Detectives. We are thrilled that you dropped by. Here, we dive deep into the world of aviation safety. From incident investigations and technical analysis to lessons learned and what they mean for safer skies. As a member of our channel, you get exclusive member-only perks. First access to new episodes, live stream discussions, and Q&A sessions. We are a community of fellow safety detectives who love aviation as much as you do. If you're passionate about aviation or just curious about how things work, we'd love to have you on board. Hit join, ring the bell to be notified, and jump into the discussions in the comments. Strap in! Because together we're going to explore aviation safety like never before. The Port Authority has indicated that they're now going to equip all their equipment with transponders for the radar system. And you did the work on that. You want to talk about it?
Certainly. Shortly after we recorded the main show, news item came out, and we're flashing one of the news stories on the screen now, that said, oh my, the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey will now equip their ground vehicles with these transponders. And John, you were telling me about how much each of these transponders will cost?
Yes, one of our listeners sent me some information that shows that a transponder out, which is all you need on motor vehicles, is in the range of $700. And I imagine if you bought a couple of $300, the Port Authority operates five airports. So if they put all their equipment from all five airports on it, they would buy a substantial number of those transponders. They probably get a much better rate than what he was able to locate online. But it was in the $700 range. Which
And without going into the great detail, ADS-B is a two-way communication system. You're getting information in or you're sending information out. They only need to send information out because ground vehicles don't need to know where aircraft are in the sky and that sort of thing.
I don't know who was thinking about the cost on that one, because it's going to cost them a lot more now.
I would hope that the airport authorities in that list of 35 that we talked about elsewhere in the show, who do not have this on their ground vehicles, will take heed from what happened with take heed or be inspired by what happened at the Port Authority in New York and New Jersey and find the $700 per vehicle and perhaps prevent another collision.
Yes. So, and we also got another comment from one of our viewers, which caused me to stop and pause and think, because the comment basically goes like, why did the airport remain open when you had an emergency? Well, oftentimes it does stay open. But in this particular case, with this particular runway that requires all the vehicles that need to get to that airplane crossing a runway, it would have made, I think it would have made sense to divert the traffic until they got the everything in place over there, or divert the traffic to JFK or Newark, right? But why keep it open? Why put these, this raise the level of risk to operations? And so I don't have an answer for that, but it's a very interesting question.
And this is some context that's useful here, in that anytime you have an aircraft landing at a runway, there's going to be a missed approach procedure. Whether you're going at some country airport with no tower, or whether you're flying into LaGuardia, there is a procedure. Either it's one that you have in your mind already, or one that is published in the documentation for that airport. So if the air traffic controller said, Flight XYZ, please go into a holding pattern or divert to another airport, that's something that's a routine thing. That's not an emergency. That's something that every pilot, every airline pilot especially, is ready to do if the need arises. And all that had to happen is they get the word from air traffic control, they do their procedure, and they're no longer anywhere close to that runway.
It's just there's so many chains links in this investigation, that I hope the NTSB digs into that question. Why? So we have the transponder issue, and we have why was the airport remaining open while
And that part of
remaining in operation? It didn't have to close the airport. But they could have just diverted traffic for a little bit.
and that part of the qu of that question rather has to be addressed not just by the controllers in the tower, but by the FAA itself. What were the procedures that are at this airport that the FAA has to approve that allowed this to happen? Now, is this something that has happened routinely, or something that was a one-time thing and it happened to be the night that this accident took place? I don't know, but I do hope the NTSB asks and answers questions like the ones we just had here.
Yes, the purpose of today is to talk about questions that the NTSB needs to ask and get answers for. So we've already identified a couple in and around the fire truck, why it didn't have the transponders, and what factors may have impeded the driver of the fire truck from seeing the red light. And reading up on the red lights and the source of lights for the color red, one of the things that, and again, I'm not a doctor, I don't fully understand this. But apparently, the red lights that are given through a normal incandescent bulb, like we all use right now in our homes and elsewhere, operates in a little different frequency than LEDs, light-emitting diodes that are red. And again, online, which isn't always the best source of information, but there is a lot of discussion about the differences in the source of light can impact certain people differently. I guess, and the way I read that is that the LEDs to certain people that have a deficiency in colors, it is even worse than just a regular red bulb. So I don't know that, but at least we will know more about it because the NTSB needs to ask and answer those questions. If we have those kinds of lights at airports and certain people can't see them, then we need to know who can't see them and mitigate that some way. Maybe they don't drive the truck out there. Maybe somebody else has to drive. There's things to do, but those are two big areas in the very beginning of an accident investigation that we need to get answers to. Right? Some of that's going to come from the interviews that the NTSB has probably already concluded. In this time, I believe those firemen are outside of the hospital now, so they probably had the opportunity to ask them some questions. And I want to talk about the questions for a minute, because I just had somebody just recently, last week when we were together, as a matter of fact, Todd, reference the movie on Sullenberg with the Miracle in the Hudson, and how the NTSB grilled him and was very aggressive in accusing him of having a role in the problem of dumping that airplane. Maybe he shouldn't have dumped it or whatever. That is not the style of the NTSB. The NTSB, even though they have a badge and they have the authority to sometimes be forceful, they are definitely not forceful. They will come in and ask questions. Hopefully you'll give them the answers. They're not accusatory. They want to find the problem and try to mitigate the problem. And there's all sorts of creative things that go on in there, but never, never is it accusatory. I've been dealing with the NTSB firsthand since the early 70s, on the accident side, on the other side, on both sides. And that's never, never accusatory. We go out of our way to make it anything but, because we just want the information.
Now, when it comes to the timeline, getting back to that, we're not accusing the pilots, the truck driver, or air traffic controller of anything. We're just reading the transcript, or rather the sequence of events, as listed by the NTSB. And the last 30 seconds or so is when a lot of stuff is happening. And 11:36 and 56 seconds, the truck one, the lead truck, acknowledged the request of the truck one to cross the runway. Rather, the truck one requested to cross the runway. The local controller gave them a clearance to cross. A few seconds later, 37 minutes and 7 seconds, basically 11 seconds later, the truck one crew acknowledged the clearance and began moving along the taxiway toward the runway. At this point, the jet was about 3,700 feet away from that taxiway intersection and at 87 feet altitude. The aircraft is less than a mile away. It's going basically, I don't know, about 2 miles a minute and 87 feet from touchdown. And this truck was given, and the other 7 trucks were given clearance to cross the runway. Now, remember, there are 7 vehicles, not just one. So you think, oh, maybe they could have scooted across in time. I don't know where the other 6 vehicles were, but it seems to me that's an awfully close fit. Let's keep going. The aircraft, 4 seconds later, crossed the runway threshold. Truck 1 was traveling at only about 11 miles an hour, 12 miles an hour, 400 feet from the edge of runway 4. Okay, so you think, okay, maybe they have some time to stop. A second later, and here's where I'm kind of confused. It says, the local controller gave a taxiing instruction to another airplane and immediately afterward instructed truck 1 to stop. Now, if the controller started saying this at 12 seconds after the minute, 11:37 to 12 seconds, talk to one airplane, then talk to the truck to stop, how many seconds after that did the truck actually get an instruction to stop? Be that as it may, the truck's speed had increased. The jet was only 2,550 feet away from taxiway D, 30 feet altitude and 133 knots ground speed. The aircraft was committed to land. If they had not already executed a missed approach, this airplane was going to land no matter what. Whether they would put the gas on immediately and try to take off again, which they didn't apparently, this was a situation where there was going to be an airplane landing one way or the other. 5 seconds later, main landing gear of the airplane touches down, 1,400 feet away. Ground speed 128 knots. And at this point, according to the NTSB, there was a transfer of control in the cockpit from the first officer who had been doing the landing to the captain. This is not normal during a landing. Typically, one pilot does everything from takeoff to landing during a flight. There's a transfer of control, usually if there's a non-normal situation going on, especially during landing. So presumably, and the NTSB didn't say this, the crew of the aircraft knew they were in a situation, were trying to take action to deal with the situation. 11:37 and 20 seconds. This is only 3 seconds after the main landing gear touched down. The local controller again instructed the truck to stop. The airplane was starting to hit the brakes. but the truck was just 100 feet from entering the runway and traveling at 29 miles per hour. Now, I don't know what kind of fire truck this was, but fire trucks are larger than average vehicles. In my regular automobile, if I'm going 30 miles an hour, could I stop within 100 feet? Maybe. I'm not sure if a fire truck would stop within 200 feet at that speed. That's my opinion. It's up to the NTSB to say whether or not there was enough time at this point for the truck to brake and possibly avoid entering the runway. And one
That is
second
right.
after this, by the way, the runway entry lights extinguish, which is a moot point at this point because the truck was almost at the runway.
But here we are in the first few seconds of this leading up to the accident, last, call it 2 minutes before the accident, and we already have four major questions. The transponder, why it wasn't there? Was it a cost item? Right? This accident is going to cost them a hell of a lot more than transponders. So the transponder issue, the issue of could the truck could have stopped, the issue of communications between the tower and those vehicles, the visual communication between the light system and the truck. Right. So there's four areas that could have prevented this accident if it worked properly, or if we understood it properly. So the NTSB will be focusing on all of those beforehand. The background of the fireman, the background of the controller. I personally think the controller is between a rock and a hard place. He had three positions working. I bet that airport at that time, because of the weather, was busier than they believed when they decided to put two people in the tower. All right, so when you've cutting your staff down to two people in the tower, two people doing four jobs, because the airport is essentially sleeping. The airport's getting down, a flight here or a flight there, no big deal. But all of a sudden, this particular night, we got an emergency working. We still got a number of airplanes coming and going at 11:30 at night at LaGuardia. That's unusual. So we got a number of airplanes looking to come in and go out. The going out is normally not, there's not a lot of airplanes after 10 o'clock at night, LaGuardia. So we have delays and we got those people. So the decision to put two people in the tower to do those jobs will be called into question. And the answer that that's what we always do is not a good answer. So there's people in the FAA that are going to be have to answer some of those questions in detail. But here we go. We got four good questions, areas that the NTSB is going to have to deal with. So on our next show, unless something happens to divert us, we're going to take it to the next step and say and look at what the airplane was doing at the same time, what could have been done there. See what that has to say. And we're going to walk through that report piece by piece and just ask the questions that an accident investigator would ask.
And on that note, we'd like to ask you to ask us questions. We sort of like left you with a cliffhanger here because this is an event which we're going to go into in greater detail, more so than we could do so today. But if you have questions about what we talked about, questions about the event, questions about the preliminary report, email us at flightsafetydetectives@gmail.com. And we'd love to get those questions and might even have some responses in the next show. And for those of you who are on the advertising side of things, we'd like to put your product or service in front of our audience. By all means, write to us at fsdsponsors@gmail.com. And we too will be happy to talk with you about how we can put your product or service in front of our audience. And of course, for all of you out there, if you've subscribed to our channel, thank you very much. If you haven't, please subscribe below. And if you would like to become a member and do things such as be able to watch our live shows, one of which we did about a couple hours ago. We do a live show once a month. And other member-only benefits, for example, we might have special shows that get released to members before it comes out on our regular Wednesday slot. Please do so. Go to the YouTube channel, subscribe, or join the membership as you see fit.
I know. I have to give a shout out to a couple of people who have volunteered their time and efforts, knowledge, to help us through some of the research that we have to do when we talk about issues. So I had a young man that helped us with the vision, with the Port Authority of New York's requirements for colorblindness, and the vision test, and so on. So help like that is really, really meaningful for us. And I am deeply grateful for the people who do it for us.
And this leads to my second to last word. And this is sort of like an example we just gave you here. Putting this episode together, all of our episodes, is an effort from many people. Of course, you see Greg and I and John all the time, but there are other people behind the scenes who help us regularly on shows. And sometimes, as you just said, people who help us out with special insights, the questions you send to us. And unraveling this accident is not going to be something that'll be easy. It might be another year or more before the report, final report from the NTSB comes out. But before then, there are questions we can ask, questions we should ask, and questions we hope the NTSB answers somewhere down the line.
And with that, I'll say my standard line at the end. If you're a pilot and you're going to go flying, do a pre-airport and at airport evaluation of your flight. Make sure you do the weather here, there, and everywhere in between. You know, scud running leads to accidents. And when you get to your airplane, do a good pre-flight. Still seeing lousy pre-flights out there at virtually every level. Every level seems to be rushed, light the fire, and get out of town. So please do a good pre-flight. If you don't know if you can do a good pre-flight or not, get a mechanic. You got to fly in a smaller airplane. Get a mechanic that works on and tell you what they do. Every mechanic I know that's worth it being called a mechanic starts an inspection on an airplane when he's walking up to it, not when he's at it. You're taking a look, the long look, and then the short look at the airplane. And then finally, when you get up in the air, put the head on a swivel. I just read, and I didn't follow up on it, but I just read of another near miss at one of our airports in the U.S. And that's on my list of things to look at down the road. I got the four things I think I mentioned to you earlier that we're looking at already. As we put those to bed, or at least address them for the short term, I'm going to look at near misses too, because there seems to be quite a few. And with that, please, please fly safely.
Thank you so much for listening to the show. We really value all of our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you. So if you like this, give us 5 stars inside your podcast platform.
We want to keep the conversation going with you. So we'd love for you to engage with us on our social media channels. We're on Instagram, X, Facebook, LinkedIn, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetodetectives@gmail.com. By the way, if you're watching this on YouTube, we're working on growing this channel, and it really helps if you all comment. So please do that. We read them all.
And be sure to subscribe.
For decades, Avemco Insurance Company has been an advocate for pilot safety by promoting and sponsoring continuous pilot training and education. One of their initiatives has been to reward pilots who actively participate in being more proficient with savings on their insurance premium through the Avemco Safety Rewards Program. Pilots save by earning new ratings, getting recurrent training, participating in the Fast Team Wing program, and listening to podcasts like ours and other Avemco-related courses and training. Call 888-879-0389 for a free quote or visit avemco.com/flightsafety. Don't forget to tell them the Flight Safety Detective sent you for an automatic 5% off.